Where would we be without curiosity if Nikola Tesla hadn't wondered about the possibility of AC motors? We might not be sitting here today talking about the cars of the future. Curiosity is one of the most important ingredients when it comes to innovation, and you never know what's going to spark one's curiosity. Today's guest spent her early career on Wall Street, and in the ashes of the 2008 financial crisis, her spark came while standing in line at a coffee shop, and suddenly she's questioning everything. She wondered if there was something different she could be doing that might fulfill a greater purpose in her life and the lives of others. So her innate curiosity led her down the path to achieve sustainability by advancing e-mobility. And even though the number of Teslas and Chevy Volts on the road continues to grow, we're still a long way away from a complete e-world and even farther away from a sustainable one. To get there, of course, we need innovative technologies, but also we need people with bandwidth and, more importantly, the curiosity to get us there. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernardin, the VP of Strategic Automotive Initiatives here at Siemens Digital Industries Software. And next in our series, Women Driving the Future, we talk to Andrea Cole Morgan. She's the Vice President and Head of Connected E-Mobility right here at Siemens. And Andrea is on the front lines when it comes to bringing us to a fully sustainable future, because she faces the challenges of not only uniting our efforts across divisions within Siemens, but also to form key partnerships with other organizations and startups that accelerate this mission. Andrea and I discuss her journey from working on Wall Street to the head of all e-mobility strategy here at Siemens, how one of the largest corporations in the world partners with small and nimble startups, and what the 2040 sustainable world might look like. I finally put her on the spot, and in the end, asked her about her first car, if she passed her driver's test on the first try, and even her thoughts on the greatest invention of all time, as well as a few more quick hitters. So, welcome to the show, Andrea.
Thanks, Ed. Good that we could finally connect on this.
Why don't we start off and just briefly tell us a little bit what your position is at Siemens and what the responsibilities are.
I'm leading a department called Connected E-Mobility. It's been in existence since 2017, so still fairly new. We're moving into our third fiscal year as of October 1st. And our focus and our job is really to innovate the future of mobility. As you mentioned a little bit of kind of searching around the different technologies that we have at Siemens, but also understanding what's happening in the future of mobility out in the world, around the world, and trying to understand what are the emerging trends and how can Siemens really play a role to make a difference in this important field.
Tell us a little bit about your background. I know you studied in international economics and political science in the U.S. and went on to Spain for an MBA. How did all this lead you to becoming the head of the group that you're working on now in e-mobility?
During those different stations, my journey has felt a little bit random, but it started off in studies background was because really I wanted to pursue a law degree. And then I suddenly found myself in finance. Then I suddenly found myself in Spain. And with hindsight, there was definitely kind of an undercurrent throughout all of those changes that was really kind of something was pulling me towards more challenge and more change. And I think that kind of while it was my educational foundation, it really was more about a journey of curiosity and kind of finding a way to combine all of these different experiences along the way. But I would say the biggest thing that brought me to working in technology innovation is ultimately the curiosity and the need for continuous challenge.
It sounds though like your curiosity changed over time, because initially your curiosity was focused on economics and political science.
And that's what ultimately took me. I was working in Charlotte, North Carolina, and then quickly moved to New York City and spent some time in finance. But, in 2007, 2008, things turned a little bit. And I kind of spent some time thinking about, is this really what I want to do?
the financial crisis of 2007 and 8 is an experience of a lifetime, I would think. That had to leave a lasting impression on you.
Some say experience of a lifetime and associate that with positive things. It definitely leaves a lasting impression and had a huge forming impact on who I am today and how I also go about some of my decisions. I mean, I'll never forget the day that 200 bankers were on a boat on the Hudson and our BlackBerries buzzed with all of these security downgrades from the rating agencies. As I said, forced me to really reflect on what I wanted to do with my professional time. You know, that combined with a story that I've told a few times around an incident in a coffee shop in Times Square, it was kind of the nail in the coffin. And I said, hey, I think my time is better spent doing something that for me has a little bit more purpose.
Tell us about what happened in that coffee shop.
We had a Starbucks coffee shop downstairs in the lobby. I went down just the same as I did every other day. Standing in the back of the line waiting for a couple tourists that were in front of me to thumb their way through their English-speaking guide and stumble their way through then also a Starbucks order, which is a language in and of itself. And they were met with a huge amount of hostility on the other side. And for me, it was just kind of a moment of reflection where I said, here I am, young in my career, in the middle of a global financial crisis. My life is somehow still a little bit easy. And kind of for whatever reason, this moment of watching these tourists struggle through their languages and paired with what I was going through professionally at the time, I said, hey, what would my reaction be and how would I kind of address challenges if I was the underdog, if I was in kind of had the cards stacked against me? Would it still be this easy? The next day I registered for the entry exam for business school. This was in April of 2010. And in August, I moved to Spain. Didn't speak Spanish. Didn't even take any. I took a couple Rosetta Stone lessons before I went, but that didn't help me when I got locked into a bathroom. It didn't help me even be able to call for help. So it really did throw me into the deep end to kind of start challenging myself in a different way. And that was kind of a perfect bookend to my finance career because it really cemented a couple reflections and learnings and a pretty strong confidence that I was going to let myself be stronger guided by purpose than anything else.
So now you're in a new country, getting an MBA. So your focus must have shifted away from finance to other aspects of business, I would imagine.
When I started studying, I very quickly started gravitating towards topics in sustainability and ended up president of the Clean Tech Club, where I already started dabbling in these technologies, learning a little bit more about what innovations were evolving.
What does a Clean Tech Club do?
So it's a lot about post-school opportunities. So there was a lot of kind of bridging the gap between career opportunities in this space, exchanging a lot of information with those interested students. We were a small cohort of just 180 students. So, you know, everybody knew everybody, but it was really a community where we could really focus on these technologies and the trends that were evolving at that time, typical that you would have in any also undergrad university club. And that was really some of my first touch points and ultimately where Siemens ended up on the radar screen.
What's the number one issue you think we face when it comes to sustainability?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm going to go back in time and put on my sustainability hat.
You're sitting in the Clean Tech Club. What were you talking about? What was the thing that got everyone in the club the most excited about solving?
I mean, around that time, we're also looking at the emergence of electrification in transportation. You had more conversations about electrifications of public transport at that stage, but soon around the corner, Tesla was going to hit the world stage in a large fashion. But some of these, I think that there was really the transition away from coal. So we were really still in the early days of social acceptance and commercial viability for transportation electrification. That's where we spent a lot of our time talking and getting away from some of the greenwashing policies of corporations from the early 2000s.
So you found your calling, and now you're moving into, I guess, the transportation industry or the mobility industry. Why Siemens?
Why not Siemens? For me, and I know that sounds so cliche, but when you take a look at the portfolio, when you take a look at the seismic shift in the transportation industry, unfounded, you know, in the last, we haven't seen anything like this since the turn of the century. Siemens has a huge opportunity to make a big difference. And unfortunately, the lion's share of the media covers the startups, but there's a massive need for somebody who has the staying power, like a Siemens, to make these types of transformations. And we've done it before, and I want to be part of us being influential in the future of mobility as well.
Well, there's always that startup, big company tension. Can a big company like Siemens be as nimble as a startup?
I think it's not a competition. It's a collaboration. And I think that this is really something that needs to be, you know, this tension between big corporates and startups. It needs to be demystified quite quickly, because there's definitely a coexistence, a need for a coexistence. And I think success is only there for the changes that we need to make with a coexistence. And so I don't spend too much time thinking about the competition space, but understanding what value Siemens can bring and what value do different potential partners play. And we have a lot of conversations with startups, and they nimble speed, but that comes at a cost to some of their technology platforms and sometimes not. And so there's really an opportunity in this space for collaboration, but it's not always, you know, the easiest or the most natural conclusion for making change.
So startups are a key part of the strategy, would you say, especially when it comes to figuring out who you want to partner with?
When you take a look at what we're trying to do, we're trying to address the need to improve mobility, make it safer, make it more accessible, make it more inclusive, make it cleaner for communities around the world. Siemens can do a lot of that. Siemens can't do all of that. So yes, startups, other companies, competitors, it's really the playground for ecosystems. It's the playground for partnering. Collaborations with startups is a core tenet of the strategy.
Now, when you started at Siemens, you were initially focused on EV charging infrastructure, but then that position evolved to be something bigger.
Actually, the original, my first touch point with what we call connected e-mobility was a strategy project. So I had just gotten out of Siemens Consulting, joined the corporate strategy department, and my first project and my only project there was based on a question: what is Siemens doing in EV charging? A couple decisions had gone back and forth in the past, and really what was happening outside in the external market was the initial signs of fast moving adoption for EVs. But there was no charging infrastructure. I started looking into it and very quickly uncovered, if you will, a vast community around the world, Siemens employees that had been working tirelessly, various different projects around the future of mobility. Some of them in autonomy related avenues, some more in connected vehicle technology, obviously electrification, and even the emergence of some innovations, taking a look at what is the potential play for Siemens in shared mobility. And I raised my hand and I said, yeah, we may have the need to open the aperture a little bit and take a broader view and see if we can't find a strategy to make our way through this, because there's a huge opportunity for impact for Siemens.
So that's your responsibility then, to take autonomy, connected, electric, shared mobility, and figure out how to piece them together in light of the capabilities that Siemens has, right?
That's one part of it. And where we have technologies that already exist, pull them together and find a way to put them into the hands of the right customers. That's working a lot together with our businesses. But then also understanding what is coming around the corner. What's the next wave of innovation? And moving from defining the strategic concept all the way through to the technical development, and then working together in lockstep with our businesses and external customers to make that a reality.
How do you go about figuring out how to get all these pieces to work together?
First, you start with a deep breath. It's a journey in perseverance. And I think that anybody who's ever done a change program or led a journey of change and of this magnitude can understand the feeling. But I think that from day one, what I started to do first was ask a lot of questions. It's really trying to understand who's doing what. What are their challenges? What have they tried in the past? What worked? What didn't? And mapping that picture to what is happening externally. What are cities trying to do? What are some of our Siemens customers trying to do? And finding a way through that. It sounds like chaos, but it is. But I think finding creativity and chaos, and then finding your way through that is the fun.
You've said in the past that pulling together this group and you're pursuing this goal, right, in this mobility field is one of your greatest achievements. What about it makes you feel that this is your greatest achievement?
I go back to the people that are working on this. When I said about contacting these people, understanding what they've been doing, a lot of these people have been leading a charge, sometimes individually, almost in a way, somebody coming along and saying, hey, I noticed that you're doing something and I wanna figure out how we can make this bigger, more impactful, how we can connect you here, here, and here, and how we can get you the right resources to make this hard work that you've been doing a reality. The reaction you get from people is hugely rewarding. And it's not about taking their idea and making it mine. It's about finding ways to help them get this to being something that's impactful. And that's ultimately why they started doing it. When we're talking about innovations, nobody comes along and says, hey, in the last 20% of your week, can you try and come up with some new idea? It's normally something sparked an idea, some inspiration that they got, or something that they gleaned from a customer challenge. And so really having the ability to breathe some life into what these people have been working on for so many years, to me is personally rewarding.
Technology for technology's sake doesn't always make sense, but figuring out how to make technology impactful, it sounds like that's what is really satisfying for you.
It's easy to throw technology at problems. It's more difficult to have it actually solve the problem. And I think that when we talk about the problems and the challenges that we're dealing with in mobility, again, it's people are dying on our streets in cities because of traffic-related incidences. People are sick because of our transportation emissions. We've got to do something about that. And cities around the world now more than ever are acutely aware of just how delicate of a situation this is. They're not getting reelected. Their funds aren't flowing in from national governments into local governments if they're not aimed at solving these types of problems. And so I think that it's absolutely paramount that Siemens rises to that challenge and becomes part of that solution, and that we're not just pumping technologies out and then searching for the problem that it can solve.
And that's a great goal. But at the same time, you have to think about the people you're working with. That must be a challenge to try and get people to work across divisions where they may not have worked across before to achieve what you're trying to do here.
Again, it really comes down to understanding the person. I baseline assume good intent. And you can assume that everybody that I talk to has a different incentive. They have a different personal ambition, a different professional target that they're going towards. I have to play with efficiency. I have to try and understand what are those motivations to the extent that makes sense, or to the extent that they're willing to let in. But I think that really understanding this at a human level allows you to break down some of the barriers, because understanding where they're headed and where are the tensions, and talking about that not just one time but consistently, allows us to stay focused on what is the goal, tackle quite tactically the different barriers that come out, and then really ultimately execute. I am not a business unit within this organization, which means if I want to be successful, a business has to be successful. They have to make money. They have to be the ones that book it. And that means that I really have to understand what are their priorities, what are their strategies, what are they focusing on, what are they not focusing on, and how does that play out into the individuals within the different businesses? And then together we pivot and make sure that we're anchored in that external customer value and then make it happen.
One of the greatest challenges when you're trying to innovate and achieve these goals, cross-divisional goals, is the challenges that you're challenging the old order. Can you give us an example of when you were challenging the old order?
Who doesn't like a good Machiavelli quote? Innovation, kind of in the nature of and definition, takes a lot of perseverance. And if you try to do something new, if you try to change the future, sometimes you're even going as far as disrupting the old order. And that's kind of where I go with that quote. You're naturally going to have distraction and detractors. We're humans. Most of us are inherently trained to do good things and then repeat them. Not to do a good thing once and then immediately move on and do something better or do something different.
And you want to share?
If you just take a look at electric vehicles in general, the ultimate aim we're talking about is decarbonizing transportation. But you can see across the industry, people stumbling their way through, moving away from the old order. And you can spend a lot of time criticizing. I mean, even criticizing these people, especially take auto OEMs, and they're rooted in combustion engines. That's how they've been for the last 100 years. Now you've got somebody who comes along and says, okay, what's going to be electric? Yeah, I mean, even BMW announced last week, I think, that they're moving towards a full electric platform built in Hungary in the next couple of years. When you take a look at the old order, yeah, now Elon Musk is looking a little less radical these days, with each and every one of these kind of strategic pivots. You can spend a career looking back and saying, I told you so, or you can put your head down and keep executing and moving forward. And I think that it's tempting to architect a I told you so approach, but it doesn't get you anywhere.
When it comes to sustainability, not everyone in the world is in lockstep, as we know. Mm-hmm. How do you see the fact that maybe in North America, our goals for sustainability might be different than they are in Europe or wherever it might be?
There's definitely innovations that fit better into one region or another. And then there's China that needs and takes and develops everything into an impressive scale. But let me speak about my personal experiences and what I can attest to. I mean, I'm American, I grew up in the US, away from public transportation. Closest thing was the use of the DC Metro. Now I come in, I live in Europe, I don't own a car, I haven't owned a car in more years than I did own a car. I take public transport everywhere, whether it's to work or to take a train into the mountains to go hiking. It's a very different system, but it's also changing. I mean, 9 months ago, I would have said, absolutely, yes, there's a different kind of perception and acceptance. But now with COVID, you've got a rapid change, almost, I would say, backwards, where we're going back towards personal vehicle ownership. That's up. Vehicle miles traveled is up in both the US and Europe. So it's going to be interesting. But what I will say is that public transport systems will be and have to be the backbone of the cities in the future. And I would love to see the US adopting more of that, because I think from a quality of life perspective, it's uncomparable.
So you don't own a car?
I do not.
Oh, so you're a true believer then in alternative transportation?
Yes.
Practicing, I guess you could say.
Practice what I preach, walk the talk. No, I think that it's also, I've sat with top management of some of the world's largest vehicle manufacturers, and they ask me what car I drive, and I tell them I walk in a pair of Veya sneakers. It doesn't kill the conversation, but it provides a different perspective, because ultimately that's what they're in competition with when we talk about mobility as a service, and in more so now, not in competition, but what they need to design their future offerings for. Somebody like me who may need a car for part of my journey, but may want to walk most of the time, or I ride my bike, but I can't get everywhere with my bike. And some days I don't want to get everywhere with my bike. I don't think it is something that brings a downside, but rather a different perspective and helps also complement the view when we're talking about designing innovations for different types of challenges.
In your work at Siemens, you worked in the past closely with Roland Busch, who is now our new CEO. How did he help you in achieving your goals so far?
First and foremost, he's from a vision perspective, has worked long and hard on tackling the challenges of cities. He was, I think, instrumental in setting up the infrastructure in cities, has had a strong history in mobility, and that's also a topic that has stayed pretty close to his heart. Together, we set up this connected e-mobility. And for me, the vision that he had, it gave me the freedom to think big. The empowerment that he gave me the courage to kind of experiment and to go out to establish a community outside of Siemens, to ask questions that really helped me gain some valuable insights into what are the Siemens customers really struggling with, what are cities trying to do, how can we help, and then interpret that back into tangible innovations.
What do you think he'll be pushing the company to think big about now that he's CEO?
I won't speak for him. I think that if you take a listen to some of his opening remarks, where he's been leading the company going over the past months, and where he has set his visions, it's really this IoT transformation and the idea of transforming the everyday is his claim. And that's something that for me personally and within our department, we can fully ascribe to, because mobility and also the future of mobility and what we deal with in the innovation space that we play in, it really is transforming the everyday. It really is an opportunity to impact through business-to-business endeavors, impact the everyday lives of people, because, you know, mobility is a basic human right for all. Unfortunately, it's not accessible to all, but through innovation and innovations with purpose, I think that it's something that we can strive for.
We're talking about the future. Let's pick a year, 2040. Walk us through what you think the urban landscape, the urban neighborhood's going to be like. What do you see
20 years from now? So we've got two decades of change, and I think that you'll have more fortified changes that you are already experiencing and seeing on the streets today. There's lots of talk about streets and sidewalks turning into parks, and I think that will happen. You will see the repurposing of space in cities. You're going to see more street side cafes. They're going to be here to stay. And you're going to also see more autonomous vehicles moving around inner city areas. I think we're going to park our cars on the outsides of cities, and we're going to use them in a shared capacity to take one-off trips here and there, but not park them under or next to our house. And we can repurpose some of these spaces, parking spots, parking garages, parking lots, even our own home garages, especially in the U.S., for different purposes and more important purposes. Things like housing, housing crisis co-presents with urban areas. And I hope that we use this space and repurpose it in 2040 for more important things like housing for disadvantaged communities. I think we're going to spend a lot more time outside. I think that's also a habit that we're seeing, and that's going to bring a new energy to cities. Whether it's the sidewalk cafes or it's going to be outdoor collaboration spaces that are also offered by different businesses or co-working spaces. You may see or hear rather drones delivering something overhead and those guys humming through our city streets. But I think that this is really an opportunity to hopefully also usher small businesses back into urban centers.
Let's imagine a workday. Let's start with a workday in the year 2040. So specifically, how is all that going to change what I do? How do you see your day in 2040 evolving from when the alarm goes off to getting to the office and then getting back home? Describe the world more at that detail level, how all these great improvements you talked about, how are they going to specifically change my life?
I'm just trying to think about how old I'm going to be in 2040 and if I'm still going to want to be working. So,
tell you what, that could be part of it, right? You're not even working anymore. This would be even better. Or you work maybe whenever you want.
Well, I think that opens into a completely different topic. We want to go into the future working setups, but take a work day. I mean, ultimately, I think that there's going to be no one typical work day that we're used to today. And transportation mobility is going to be a big part of that. But you wake up and I think that we're still going to move towards a dedicated area or one of a series of dedicated areas to do our jobs. You know, I think that there's not going to be the sound of horns. There's going to be more the sound of the quiet sound of electric vehicles moving through a city, moving you and others, people you know, people you don't know. I think we will go back to asset utilization that manifests in shared mobility. And I hope that it's an energy and an environment that stimulates conversation and stimulates communities coming closer together.
It seems that technology sometimes, though, brings us apart. And certainly under COVID, we're not eye to eye and face to face as much. Do you think technology will eventually bring us back together? So physically, we'll be working together or talking? How is it going to change how we interact?
Sure. And that's designed that way because that's what we need right now. We need to not be side by side with one another.
Generally speaking, right, people are spending time looking at their phones more than they look at the people that are in the same room with them sometimes, it seems like.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunate. And, you know, when you talk about transportation investments and you talk about designing cities and transportation systems of the future, you also very quickly come into confrontation with the idea of fully decentralized workplaces, fully decentralized urban areas. Everything comes to me. I don't go to anything. That may be. That's not a world that I want to design for. I think humans are naturally social beings. I think we do want to be together. And I think we're going to have a reckoning with our technologies and how do we want to interact with others versus keyboard warrior type behavior. I can't predict the future. I leave that to the trained futurists. But I can do my part to design these transportation innovations that improve the environments that one is in. You can't digitalize mobility. You can digitalize the experience, but you will always have, mobility will always include moving from point A to point B. And until we have beaming systems, we're going to have a physical asset that gets us from point A to point B. And I want to make those inclusive. I want those to be shared environments. And that means that they have to be accessible. They have to be safe. They have to be clean.
One of the things you see in society now is you have the urban people, the suburban people, the rural people. If transportation becomes such that it's affordable and quick, those divisions may start to, I'm not sure if they'll disappear, but certainly lessen. Do you see that as a key role of transportation, just making us physically accessible to wherever we need to be or want to be, and then ultimately that could impact how society works in general, eliminating these groups of city, country, suburban, whatever it might be?
I think it will play a role. I think we have to design systems that are more inclusive, more accessible in at the beginning, because what you can't have is mobility systems that are rolled out similar to the way that in the US we rolled out highway systems, where we laid asphalt through neighborhoods. We cut off opportunity by the way to provide opportunity to those who already had it. So we doubled down for the haves and we doubled down negatively for the have-nots. And I think that transportation in this next wave has to reverse that. And we have to design a system for the many.
What's a feature of a system that's for the many that we don't have now?
Take the suburbans. There's a lot of innovation focused on what's happening in cities. But if you start talking about rural Germany, we're talking about farmland, and they have no access to city or urban city centers. They don't have the same access to medical facilities, if not for a public transit bus that is heavily subsidized. And we need to, one, make sure that we've got not just the technology, but also the systems in place in order to make sure that service is maintained. Now, there's some companies out there right now that are 100% dedicated to only focusing on these use cases. And I think we need to give them the same attention and a day at the table as we do for those that are looking at pumping micro-mobility into urban centers where we've got 6 options for mobility, where we're talking about on the conversely that they only have the opportunity for 1.
If you had a magic wand, you could solve one big problem. That's the first step towards this vision. What problem would you solve? This is your chance. You can rub the genie bottle. It solves a problem for you. What would you pick?
I would want the autonomous vehicles to make a breakthrough in their kind of final stretch of their AV development, because they think that autonomous vehicles have a huge ecosystem ahead of them in terms of new opportunity, new economies, new jobs, and so on. And I think that if we could break through there and get AVs out on the streets in a safe and an effective manner, meaning they're not shutting down traffic systems because they're moving safely but slowly, for me that would set a huge groundwork for a lot of different innovations that we could tackle from a Siemens perspective.
Well, listen, thank you so much. We've gone from studying political science in North Carolina to Wall Street to Spain to Germany to solving the problems of the year 2040. I want to end up with just a series of quick questions. You can answer them in a single line if you want to elaborate a little bit, but I'm just going to shoot them at you. And if you're ready, we'll get started and then we'll be good to go. What's the first car you ever bought?
Only had one. It was a Honda Accord gifted to me when I was 19.
Did you name it?
I called it the Lexus, even though it was a Honda. Long story.
As close as you could get to the Lexus. Why'd you call it a Lexus?
We always just joked around that we were taking the Lexus because all of my friends had nicer cars than I did. I didn't care about cars. I played soccer when I was in university, and so a lot of the athletes had all these fancy cars, but then we always ended up in my little Honda Accord.
Did you pass your driver's test on the first try?
Passed on the first time because my driver's ed teacher was dependent on me, because the day after I passed my driver's license test, I could start taking his kids to school with me.
That probably influenced the grade, I imagine. Huh?
I missed one point.
So you have your driver's license. What's the first drive you took?
I drove myself onto the interstate in rain, Interstate 95. Thinking I was going to have some solid interstate practice. Then I realized I was driving onto the interstate in DC rush hour traffic, so I didn't go very fast.
You don't own a car now, so what's your favorite way of getting from point A to B?
By foot.
If you could have any car in the world, free, no charge, what would it be?
An APA Classic, but an E version.
Well, I don't think I've ever heard of an APA.
You're Italian. You've got Italian roots, man. These are little trucks that you see in the these little three-wheeler trucks that you see in the Italian mountain towns.
Oh yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah, with the real loud little motors. But of course, it's an EV version.
There is an EV version. They have them all, very popular in India. They've made tuk-tuks out of them.
What's the greatest invention of all time?
The snooze button.
I love it. If you could uninvent one thing, what would it be?
Sorry, I'm going through a filtering process for appropriateness. Reality television?
Now, we always ask this question on the Future Car Podcast. You're going from Munich to Hamburg, let's say, the year 2040. Autonomous car, it's your living room on wheels. You can have anything you want in your living room on wheels. Describe your car, your autonomous car of the year 2040.
4 or 5 hours, it's going to be a fast-moving autonomous vehicle to get us to Hamburg. But I would like to take some friends and family so multi-seater. It wouldn't be a bad thing to have a nice wine cooler installed as well, to have the perfectly chilled bottle of wine for the trip.
Would it be a German wine?
No.
Italian?
Because you're Italian, I'm going to say yes. At least.
So what wine would you be chilling if you weren't talking to an Italian?
Let's go with it. We'll take a German Riesling and Brunello. Then I would say a Burgundy French.
Oh, perfect.
Let's go with tasting of the world. We've got a couple hours to get there, so there's no point in taking just one bottle of wine.
That's right. One every two-thirds of an hour sounds about right.